You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Turn my mic on. Welcome, Gareth Shoots.
You're right.
In here this evening. Thanks to audioculture.co.nz. We're talking about the Bluestone Store. It's New Zealand's oldest commercial building.
Yeah, they built it in the late 1800s. It's like a brick building, but modern people will know it more. Probably more recently as a bar, like in the 2000s they fixed it up as a bar. But we're talking about the musical sort of 20 years where it was like one of Auckland's hottest music venues. So I wrote an article about it for Audio Culture. And the fun thing about it is it just covered over that 20 years from 1960 to 1980, like the whole face of Auckland music changed. And so Bluestone Room is just this great encapsulation of like how different it was. So yeah, the article on Audio Culture starts off with like its first incarnation as a music place was the Top 20 Club, which was like band just played the top 20 of the charts in order. So this band, Larry's Rebels, had to just learn the entirety of the chart and then just play
every, like a weekly thing?
Yeah, so they're just constantly learning new songs. Because you got to think, in those days, PAs were just not good. Like, most bands didn't play with PAs. They just had a little vocal amp that did the vocals, and then they had all the guitar amps. And so if you went to a place that to just listen to music, say a coffee lounge or whatever, it'd just be a jukebox playing. Like, there wasn't the whole PA thing. So if you wanted to hear like a proper sound of a band playing the latest hits, you had to see an actual band playing live throughout the 60s. So yeah, they had that role. The other crazy thing, of course, in the 60s was no alcohol, because alcohol sales had to stop at 6 o'clock, and you weren't actually allowed to have music in places that sold alcohol anyway. So this is a time when people would be, it's like doing, just like teenagers would go there. So you think of venues now, you think of late night and it's all drinking and overage people. But this, a lot of the busiest gigs were like Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, and it was like 14, 15 year olds in the crowd and stuff. So the contrast is kind of crazy with like, there's a story in the Audio Culture article about Max Merritt playing there. And they said, you know, they'd have the early part of the gig where they'd just be playing the music for hours. And then their saxophone player would turn up with the whiskey. And then they'd all just do shots of whiskey. And then it would get to like 1 a.m. and they'd all get out the amphetamines to stay awake and just be popping all these pills till like 2 or 3 in the morning. So because they'd be playing so long. And yeah, the alcohol had to be really subtle, but the amphetamines were just not a known thing. So, you know, people could kind of get them for dieting and stuff, and so they're almost more available or whatever.
Now, I mean, so the venue's not selling alcohol. Are they just, is it just got a flat hireage fee and then they ticket it, they book it out? How did it work around that time?
Yeah, so it was a lot of selling coffee and selling toasted sandwiches and food and stuff. So it was more like a weekend afternoon club or something where you'd be paying a flat fee, which was a more reasonable amount of money, and that's what the band would get paid from. But I mean, these bands were playing such long sets for such minimal amount of money, but then they had gigs every night of the week, so you could almost make a living. Though one of the guys in the story talks about paying a few nights a week and then and staying up till 2 in the morning and then going to work every day. Like, it wasn't actually enough. So some of them would be doing the hard yards if you weren't in the main band or whatever. But it's funny to see who went through, even in those early days, top 20. Like the compere there was this guy, Hugh Lynn, who'd moved up from Wellington, and he was like just a really interesting guy. Like, even when he was young, he like did dancing competitions and stuff, and then he like, through being the compere at top 20, he realized they needed security, so he started a security firm. He realized the local TV show Come On needed go-go girls, so he started a go-go dance girl academy and stuff. And through his security work at top 20, he actually went into doing security at the big gigs. And of course in the 70s he actually did start getting the big PAs, and so being security at these big gigs like Elton John and stuff, he slowly realized, oh, I could be a promoter. And so Hugh Lynn went into being one of the most massive New Zealand promoters in the late 70s and 80s. And then from that, started a record store and did the label behind Herb's, recording studio, I mean, and a record label. Yeah. So a lot of people came through there.
Wow. Shall we play a tune, Gareth? What would you like to
start with? Yeah, I thought we'd play Larry's Rebels. This is a song they wrote themselves, so this is their one chance to play their own song, because it was written by a friend of theirs, Roger Skinner, and it won the Silver Scroll Award at the time and stuff. And so this would have been one time when they were playing the top 20 and they got to play their own song, because this was an original.
We're in the midst of Audio Culture with Gareth Shute. We're just taking a trip down memory lane and taking a look at his article, The Bluestone Store, aka you might not from contemporary times, is The Bluestone Room.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're just talking about how that venue followed the course of music history over the 60s and 70s. So the next thing that happened was it was taken over by Radio Hauraki, and they called it 1480. Do you know why they would have called it 1480?
Because it was their frequency at the time?
Yes, it was their AM frequency, pre-FM. It's good. No FM. Yeah, it's so funny.
I mean, how did that change what was happening in the venue?
Well, it's slowly changed more because I think they don't seem amazingly different now, but when Jimi Hendrix and the Cream came through, the next two venues in the Bluestone Room, 1480 Club and Bo Peeps, really started to have a lot more of that Hendrixy sound. And we started getting bigger amps around the cusp of 1970, like some local amp manufacturers like Holden started making those sort of big Marshall stacks. And so the whole sound kind of changed there. The alcohol laws changed, but they didn't catch up straight away. But so one of the main bands that had a residency at Bo Peeps was called The Human Instinct, and they had like their guitarist was Billy T. K. Senior, so not the Aaron's son,
yeah,
the older one, and he had a massive Marshall stack. And then their drummer, lead singer, was this crazy guy who played a stand-up drum kit. So he had like three timpanis and stuff. So he had this totally wild setup and just sounded like Hendrix. So going from that, what we just played, that Larry's Rebel sort of little bit psychedelic, sort of organy, but kind of mid-tempo, you almost get into metal. And the main guy, Morris Greer from The Human Instinct, also with his brother started like renovating venues around town. And so the two owners wanted to remake Bo Peeps into something even cooler. So Dave Henderson and Tommy Adderley, who had another band, Headband, that played there, they hired them to start a totally new club and make it cool in the 70s style. And so downstairs they had Grannies, which was just that usual sort of all ages rock club. But then upstairs they had Grandpa's, which was meant to be a private club, with the idea that they could give people alcohol if it was a private club. And so to go get in there, you had to have a little membership card and you're allowed to bring one friend. And so all the coolest bands played there because there were alcohol and stuff. And once you had a card, you just kept your bottle of alcohol there and then drank it there. Or they had a friend who sold alcohol out of the back of a car outside or whatever.
Yes.
And so it just became the coolest place. It was open really late, had alcohol, wasn't some crappy bar. The trouble was with the actual bars, the pubs and taverns, a lot of them were old hotels and stuff. But Lion and stuff just put bands in there that were like covers bands. So they wanted to completely control the alcohol industry as well as entertainment. So they had their own bands and they just forced them to play really banal songs. So to hear the coolest music, you go to Grandpa's. And that's why it ended up being the place where when Elton John came, for example, he went in there for a drink, and when Rolling Stones came, Keith Richards and a couple of the backing musicians of the band turned up and said, "We want to have a jam." And so they got up and had a jam at Grandpa's and stuff.
Wow.
So it was like a totally cool scene in this same space, in the upstairs part of it.
What would a membership card set you back?
Oh, I think, yeah, I think they would have cost quite a bit because it was the like coolest card in town. The only trouble was it didn't... The police were like less agreeing that it really was a private club because they could just see totally what was happening. So they kept finding them and finding them. And Tommy Adderley was doing quite well out of it. So he'd bought a house and a car and stuff. But then he ended up being taken to court so many times that he lost the car and he lost the house in the end.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy. So it totally bankrupted him.
Oh.
And the whole place went into disrepair. But I think if we play just a little bit of this Human Instinct track, you'll get a sense of how like the music had changed, because it's almost like it's almost got cowbell and stuff. It sounds like heavy metal. You can just see how the having the bigger amps and being able to make the bigger sound and having that influence of Hendrix just changed the music, even though it was just within a space of a couple of years.
All right, and hopefully we'll fix the sound as well. We did get a couple of texts about that, so hopefully fingers
crossed.
These
are old recordings. They might sound a bit hokey.
Here we go. Thank you.
walking on down by the line. Well, slow down, you gotta get in time. Keep it in mind. Knows what a city needs is a spring clean. Looking through my window to the sky. Well, I thought I blew my mind so I could hide.
Gareth, you're saying that some of these were Doug Jerabine creations.
Yeah, so Maurice Greer, the lead singer slash drummer from The Human Instinct, went to England on a bit of a fact-finding mission and met Doug Jerabine there, the old guitarist from The Embers. He used to play sort of pop music downtown at the Shirley in town, but then went to England and became this kind of cool Hendrix-y guitarist, and had recorded all these demos of this great album he was going to do. And so Maurice Greer was like, wow, these are amazing. Can I take them back and use them for Human Instinct? Mm. And Doug Jerabine was like, yeah, sure. That'd be cool. My English label will release them here. But then he became a Hare Krishna, and Doug Jerabine went off to Hare Krishna land for like 40 years. Mm-hmm. And his album never got released. So the Human Instinct albums were the only place you could hear them up until sort of 10 years ago, I think. John Baker was involved in re-releasing the Jesse Harper album, which mm-hmm. was like his pseudonym. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, it just gives you a sense. I mean, that track we played, it goes on for 9 minutes. I didn't want to play the whole thing, but it's, yeah, massive, big, heavy metal / end of psychedelic music jam out. So you can imagine what it would have been like when that bar was like that band would have really stood out, and the whole Hendrix sound coming in. Of course, with Tommy Adderley, the owner, and Dave Henderson being sued to bits by the police for selling alcohol, the place just fell apart, really. And so new owners could come in and buy the Bluestone Room and start it as something else. Unfortunately, the top floor had just been kind of left to ruin mm-hmm. over that period, but they just set up Babe's Disco downstairs, and it became a hangout of the like King Cobras, who were like the Ponsonby gang at that time, and they listened to sort of funk and disco. And the upstairs bar, the punks who had trouble finding a venue to play in approached the owners, who were kind of dodgy types, and managed to convince them to let them start a punk club there. So early Auckland punk band The Scavengers went there and tried to decorate it, and basically they got Simon Gregg, who was the manager of Suburban Reptiles. He had a big pile of enemies that he's imported. They're like all like 3 months old or whatever, but they basically just went through his enemies and cut out all the photos of punks and like glued them all over the walls and stuff, and then they just spray painted punky things and probably Nazi things and whatever punks were into at the time, unfortunately. And posters of like sadomasochist things. I don't know. Like, it was just total mess. Like,
yeah. How did they get away with it? Like, I guess if the police had been pretty present.
Well, the police. Oh, well, there are actually. If you look at on Audio Culture at the Fiona Clark images, there's a great photo of some undercover cops.
Undercover cops.
Yeah, and they're just like dressed in suits or whatever, but it's so obvious, like standing in the midst of these all these punks. And they back then all the police had moustaches and stuff, like they looked so like, yeah, it's crazy.
On your on your article, there's a great Fiona Clark photo of the Idols. Just great fashion and colour.
Yeah, they were almost an all-girls band, so they just, like, made their own punky clothes and stuff. You mean, you got to think that the only experience people had of punk down here were 3-month-old NME magazines, the covers of albums, and one Dylan Tate article that ran on the TV. Like, people didn't really know what punks looked like. So it's great to kind of look at the photos of that era and just think, oh, yeah, you're trying to be a punk. You look pretty stupid. But pretty great. Yeah. I don't know. They all look real sci-fi or something.
Yes.
They're a lot of plastic. Hey, they're real into plastic clothes. It's like the worst thing. I don't know. Yeah. I think in the 90s, people started wearing plastic pants again for a while. And it's so hot. It's the dumbest.
Yeah, like early 2000s, fashion trend. Just, you know, we're in space.
But yeah, the great thing with having the King Cobras downstairs was there were, you know, these punks would go down there with their brand new leather jackets, and these King Cobras would be like, oh, awesome, I have that.
Yeah.
So it was like quite a battleground between the two. But Simon Grigg did say, oh, you know, all that gets so exaggerated over time, it turns into this massive, like, oh, the punks and the gangs were fighting. It's like, oh, it happened like 5 times or whatever. Mm. And him and Kerry Buchanan, who's in one of the punk bands who became the hip-hop writer for Real Groove magazine and stuff, he said they used to go down there and listen to it because there was some great funk music and stuff down at Babes.
Yeah.
But yeah, the punk scene, I mean, it was just a sign of things to come. All the cool bands came through at first, like Spelling Mistakes and Ruder and all those cool bands over the first year. And then slowly it sort of these second-rate kind of bands came through. Boot Boys came through and just the violence increased and slowly it kind of started to dissipate. I mean, it's cool not having any law and just like drinking freely and ignoring the police and stuff, but then at some point it can just go to chaos.
Yeah.
And what happened in the end was they started losing money and the whole place burned down to the ground in 1979 under very mysterious circumstances. And someone... Simon Grigg sent me a very vague newspaper article about someone getting taken to court for it as well. So it's obviously insurance fraud. So that's what happened to the long run of Pluston Store as a music venue.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But had a bit of a refit.
Yeah. I mean, it's still there. The cool thing is, like you say, it's like New Zealand's oldest commercial premises. And in the early 2000s, someone came in and fixed it up and made it really nice and turned it into a bar, and it kept going right through to all the sort of COVID lockdowns and the CRL thing. So it's all earthquake strengthened, has the nice floors, and I think it's like hired for single events. But in like about 10 years back, the Punk It Up group of like punk reunions went back in there to the top floor and did his Wines reunion and played a couple of times. I think it might have a different life in the future though, because now PAs are bigger and stuff. It's the whole building's made of basalt, so it's basalt hard rock, and the interior's all wood, so it was never the greatest music venue. And modern consumers might actually want to be in a nicer
sounding
venue, I suppose.
Room. Yeah. We've just had a cool text come through, Gareth, on saying, just listening with interest, my wife and I met at Granny's 50 years ago. The music was acid rock. Also, there was Space Case and Billy TK.
Ah, yeah, Space Case, so they're like fusion jazz. So cool. Yeah, I like that era of Dr. Tree and all those New Zealand fusion-y bands.
Now, anyone out there wants to like just catch up on what we've been talking about, you can head to audioculture.co.nz. The Bluestone Store, from the top 20 to Zwines. Gareth shoots article. Shall we go out on a track, Gareth?
Yeah, well, maybe we'll listen to Scavengers, which will give you a sense of the punk scene that ended it. Thanks for having me, and yeah, check out Audio Culture. Till next time, bye. Perfect.
I'm not the same body tonight.
Listening Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just fascination.